You're listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace through conversations with innovators, educators, and decision-makers, people with solutions to today's workforce challenges.
When employers are filling open jobs, there are some groups of workers that are more likely to be overlooked for a variety of reasons. Reasons that have nothing to do with whether they can do the work or learn the skills needed to do the work. Tapping into these overlooked groups of potential employees can be value add for organizations of all sizes, enriching the workplace with a diversity of thought, life experiences, and cultural backgrounds. Joining me now to talk about one of these groups, older workers, are Paul Irving, the chairman of the Milken Institute Center for the Future of Aging, and Gary Officer, president and CEO of the Center for Workforce Inclusion. Gary, Paul, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Ramona.
Thank you, Ramona.
Pleasure to be with you.
Paul, I'm going to start with you. I want to talk about the perception of the older worker in the workforce right now.
It's a complex problem, but I was glad, Ramona, in your introduction that you talked about diversity. We're in a time in which I think, and I hope, that diversity and inclusion is understood not just as a necessity, but as an asset, as an opportunity for employers to not only enrich their workplaces, but to stimulate innovation and creativity and cross-sectoral problem solving and a lot of other opportunities. The challenge, I think, for all of us who are focused on the issues of older workers is how do we make the case? I think we're doing an increasingly good job of it. How do we make the case that age should be part of that diversity and inclusion matrix? That older adults bring something special, not just experience and wisdom and judgment, but a different perspective that will end up not just adding something nice, but necessary to the workplace.
What are some of the challenges that older workers have in the workforce right now?
Gary will have a perspective on this too. I would say, look, the principal challenge is it's an expectation that all old people are in a state of decline, diminishment. They are cognitively challenged. They've lost their edge. And nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, look, obviously, age is the principal risk factor for disease. There's no denying that. And there is a portion of our population that sadly suffers from cognitive loss, Alzheimer's disease, and other dementias. There's a portion of our population that obviously suffers from chronic disease. But I think we discount the value of experience, understanding how to navigate environments, understanding corporate politics, knowing how to get things done. I often make the case to corporate leaders that if they have the most complex, most important, most demanding skunkworks project, I'm thinking now about conversations I've had up in Silicon Valley about this, that rather than putting two really smart 27-year-old Stanford PhDs in computer science on the project, or frankly, two people my age, I'm 68, on the project who have a lot of experience and know-how, put one of each and get the creativity and risk-taking and new ideas, fresh ideas of youth, but the experience, multi-sectoral problem-solving and opportunity-creating talents and know-how of older adults, and you're much more likely not only to come up with something great, but to get it done.
And Gary, you deal with groups that are helping older workers, and many of them in underserved communities of color. So it seems like there's a double whammy against this group of people.
Well, I've got to thank you, Ramona. I'm going to tell you, I've been really troubled by the temperature in our society with respect to how we address inclusion issues, racial issues, inequity issues. And for the last couple of months, I've written a lot about it because I have to find a medium through which I can hopefully shape people's attention and opinions about this space. On the hiring side, from a local perspective, I'll use a couple of examples. One, my own example. I once ran a large portion of a think tank in Washington, D.C. We had an event for the CEO of a major tech company. My events team had to work with their events team. After the event was over, I get a phone call a month later asking for a reference for one of my 29-year-olds. They didn't ask for a reference for the 54-year-old. They asked for a reference for the 29-year-old. Why? They saw in that person their happy hour buddy. They saw that person a generational connect that the hiring person did not share with that older person. It is a nuanced experience when decisions are made on hiring, not based on experience, wisdom, and all of that, but it's based on whether or not I see in that person the happy hour buddy on a Friday night. That's one. The other is we have to accept that there is tremendous ageism, and there's a real perception that older workers are not tech savvy. So we did a study about 2 years ago in Tennessee. We sent a plane load of laptops and iPads. We hooked up the entire facility, and we tested the proficiency of older workers at this particular site. What we found was that there was a 95% proficiency rate for the use of technology in fulfilling basic functions on the job. So the lesson is, if you are employed, you will stay current. You'll keep up with technology, and therefore your skills can be transferred into new opportunities. So that's sort of one level. The second level, I think, of analysis ought to be global. If you look at what happened in the US back in March, April, May, the unemployment numbers went from 3.5% to over 20 in 7 weeks. Germany, it went from 3% plus to 5%. Germany spent over 1% of GDP on workforce training. They're consistently retraining their workforce so they can adapt to the change in nature of their economy and can withstand any significant shocks that may come out of left field to their ongoing economic environment. That's what others are doing. And somehow we have to both train our people, really address the issues of ageism, and develop solutions that helps to make sure that our society and our workforce opportunities are inclusive of all. The third piece while I'm at this is Black Lives Matter and COVID. What the two forces has created, Black Lives Matter from a racial equity standpoint and COVID-19 from a disproportionate impact of the pandemic on older and primarily African-American communities, is it illustrates the vulnerability of an enormous segment of our workforce that have been trapped in primarily low-income frontline jobs, which will likely disappear in the next decade or so. And Black Lives Matter pretty much illustrated the lack of real opportunity to both access and realize potential in the workforce. You put the two together, vulnerability plus opportunity, then you have a problem. And we as a society, I think, owe it to ourselves to honestly address those two issues head on.
Paul, do you see anybody addressing these issues, both older workers and diversity, as a broader problem?
First of all, let me just echo and endorse Gary's point. And ironically, I would have pointed, at least on the older workers front, the notion of reskilling, reimagination of their talents and all the rest, to Germany as a place that has tended to do relatively well on this front, because they've understood that with changing demography, with a much older population, it's not just the right thing to do, it's a critical thing to do for the future of their economy. And I think in a sense, by the way, Gary's making the same point. The United States, you know, Ramona, you and I both live in a majority-minority state in California. The country is going to be a majority-minority country around 2040 or so. And we're going to be a country with a much larger population of older adults as a result of historically low birth rates and increasing longevity. So if policymakers and business leaders don't react to the oldest adage, demography is destiny, then they're not only not being smart and not being fair, but they're really not doing the right thing for their shareholders, for their communities, for their other employees and the like. We really have got to engage in a radical shift about the understanding of the future of the American workforce, which is older and of color. That's where it's going. And for anybody who can't accept that, and I realize we're doing this in the middle of a convention, so I will try not to be excessively political, but for anyone who can't accept the realities of America's future, I question at least their economic patriotism. I question their commitment to, their understanding of what needs to be done to keep America strong and to invest in America's future and to realize the potential of America's changing population. So you asked me whether anyone's doing it right. I would say that there are a handful of American companies that are doing it right. Most of what we see, at least on the engaging older workers front, we see overseas. To an extent, that may be a product of the fact that population aging is happening more rapidly in both Asia and Europe than it is in the United States. Historically, we've had a fairly robust immigration policy. I'm assuming, knowing that Gary's a Brit, I'm assuming he was at some point a beneficiary of that. With doors closing in some respects, one might expect that our population will grow older just that much more quickly. So there are a series of global companies who I think are thinking about it more. Again, Gary mentioned Germany, and there are a couple who I would identify in Germany, but really nowhere near enough. I guess lastly, I just really want to underscore the point about reskilling. In the wake of the Great Recession, the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco did a study, and they looked at reemployment of people as the economy improved. And maybe not surprisingly, but disappointingly, the last group to be rehired was the oldest group. The workers suffered, particularly at the hands of an economic downturn. I fear the same thing will be true as a result of COVID, both because of the fact that older workers have not been as actively invested in as their younger counterparts, apropos Gary's story about the young talent, and because of employer fears and potentially worker fears about the risks of COVID. So, and this is, I hope we talk about kind of the tale of two cities, you know, for all of us who live lovely lives on Zoom and can function somehow this way versus the real essential workers, the people who are not just serving in hospitals and health systems, but who are delivering our food and taking care of our parents.
You know, Ramona, to illustrate Paul's point, the only country among the OECD group that's behind us on workforce spending is Mexico. So all the other 20 plus countries invest far more pursuant to their GDP on workforce training than we do. In Asian economies, you know, you have 11 very powerful and emerging economies. We would rank 9 out of 12 on aggregate workforce spend. So the answer to what Paul has eloquently presented is we have to invest more on workforce spending if we are to retrain and prepare our entire workforce, but also more pertinently, our older workforce for the opportunities that will drive the U.S. economy in the 21st century. And that's not happening. If you look at the last two stimulus packages and you look at how much was put in there for workforce training, for older workforce training, there was either zero attached to older workforce training and a nominal amount for workforce training across the spectrum in a $4 trillion combined stimulus bill. So if we're not investing in a stimulus package to help train our workforce and our vulnerable to re-enter a workforce that will they can find jobs, then how will things be under normal situations? And that's the problem. We're not investing in real time for people who are most in need, who we are going to be dependent on.
American policymaking tends to be sadly reactive, and to some extent this is a product of our broken politics, right? That we can't get people together to say, how do we make investments in the future of education, in the future of work, in the future of health, the kinds of things that will strengthen the country over the long term? We're reacting, moving from, you know, crisis to crisis, fighting about how to solve those crises. And that's the deficit of leadership we have. You know, I understand people's frustration with Washington, D.C. I don't share the values and the views of the current administration, but I understand why they're there. I understand why people feel this way. And, you know, Gary's absolutely right. If we want to change the future for American workers, we need to make investments in their skilling and reskilling. We need to understand, again, the changing demography, and we need to plan for a very different future.
We just did a new Working Nation survey that shows more than half of the workers surveyed, 56%, said they are unaware of any programs out there to learn skills, and they're unaware of how to find those programs. 66% said they've never been offered any kind of skills, upskilling, any training by their own employers. So we have businesses who are changing the way we all work because of technology, automation, but they're not upskilling the people they have. So that's where a lot of older workers, I think, lose out, younger workers too, but older workers, because if they're not upskilling the people, their skills are obsolete. And everybody out there are unaware of where these programs are. So How do we get people to buy into this idea that the reskilling is necessary? I know that's a big question and a big challenge, but I feel like there's not enough talk about it in the mainstream.
So, Ramona, this is the problem I've seen in the workforce space, which I have not seen in my previous reincarnation. We are a highly balkanized space. We have systems within the workforce movement that do not speak to each other. And when we do, we're using different languages, different terms. Oftentimes, we forget about the audience we are here to serve. If you look within the institutions, you find organizations that function almost as a mirror of their government funding sources. If you ask many of my local partners, tell me what's happening in your community. Who's coming in? Who's coming out? Who runs the local chamber of commerce? I would know more about many of these communities than the people I'm funding locally. That's a big issue. You've asked me on a podium once to tell you a little bit more about what we're doing with community college. And somehow I pretended I didn't hear the question. And I had to rephrase the question around something I could answer. Because in truth, I did not know. And that's the problem. Because the community college network are being funded through a separate set of funding relationships to the Workforce Opportunity Boards, to the National CSET network. And none of these systems, subsystems connect to each other. And when you have that, you have balkanized advocacy, you have balkanized program delivery, and oftentimes the left hand does not know what the right hand is doing. And that's a problem.
Yeah, and I'm glad Gary used the word balkanization. I think it's a really appropriate word for this problem. But it's solvable. You know, Ramona, you and I are both old enough to know, Gary's younger than us, but you and I are both old enough to remember John Kennedy's entreaty about physical fitness. You remember that?
Oh, absolutely.
I remember being in school and every kid in America, in every public, at least public school in America, I was in public school, had to engage not only in specific exercises, but there were specific tests at the end of the year, right? There was the 600-yard run and the softball throw, and you know, you had to do the number of
jumping jacks.
We did that. We responded to Sputnik and we got to the moon. If we have national leadership, this is not genius.
That's right.
If we had national leadership who simply said, we have to prepare the American population for the economy of the 21st century. What does it take in education, in employer practices, in you name it, it could be done, which is why, by the way, I always kind of push back on this notion of federalism, local controls and all the rest. To some extent, great and necessary. Things have to be customized for local communities, local cultures, et cetera. But at the end of the day, if we are a country, and boy, do I hope we're still a country, the national leadership on an issue like this, preparing us for the realities of this century, is achievable.
I agree, Paul, and this is something I picked up from, again, other systems that I've been involved in. Movement building comes from the bottom up, where you talk about the innate needs of individuals, their communities, you articulate their aspirations and their fears, and you then talk about what innate skill we're not tapping by virtue of ignoring this particular population. And then you write op-eds to local newspapers and challenge their audience to rethink how they perceive a particular audience. And then you attack philanthropy. Movement building is often fed through philanthropy support that gives you the capacity to engage your policymakers. Within our national philanthropy sector, there is $450 million in aggregate assets. Less than 5% of our philanthropic dollars goes into workforce training. Yeah. Less than 2% go into elder care and elder programs. So now we have a sector that is capable of pulling us together to de-balkanize the sector so we can better represent the population we're here to serve in our national interest. And it's not happening because A, philanthropy isn't engaged, and two, the balkanization is leading to the diminishing effect of our ability to inform policymakers to ensure that they are responsive to the needs of our population. That's a huge issue in this country.
I would make the case that while movement building requires action at the bottom, ultimately change requires action at the top too. I always say that the civil rights movement still nowhere near as progressed as any of us would like to see it. It took MLK and others in the streets, but it also took Thurgood Marshall as the Supreme Court. It even took Lyndon Johnson. The answer is we have to see this as a national priority. And Ramona, I know one of the things that Working Nation talks a lot about is not just kind of the mechanics of getting people to work, but also about the dignity of work. Work is really important to people's self-definition, sense of wellness, and sense of self-esteem. So FDR obviously recognized this in the wake of the Great Depression with the WPA. And I would say particularly in that sense, you know, the old adage, never let a crisis go to waste. One of the things I think that COVID has revealed was it Warren Buffett who said that you have to wait for the tide to go out to see who's swimming naked. Boy, are we seeing who's swimming naked in the wake of the COVID crisis. So maybe this is a time for us to recognize that the dignified, reasonably compensated, engaging opportunities for all Americans should be a national priority, and that what we need is we need leadership in Washington, and Gary's very right. We need people in the streets, not just talking about BLM as they absolutely should be, but also talking about the importance of jobs.
You know, Ramona, I have to take, and Paul has made a great point there. I'm going to tell you, a few months ago, I penned this piece called Society and Economy, because I spent so much time watching the BBC, the CBC, Sky News, and CNN, to see how the unfolding debates around our responses to COVID-19 in each country was being handled. And what I saw in those other countries was deep reflection about what kind of society do we want to be? How does that inform our respective stimulus packages? How does it hold our society together so we can reemerge in an economy that may be different? They were thinking long-term, but these countries were thinking first in a very deliberate way about society. We, by contrast, were thinking exclusively about the economy. It was, how do we get the PPP approved? How do we extend unemployment benefits? And how do we keep the ship afloat? We weren't thinking about the implications of this pandemic on the lives of the most vulnerable, and how we must avoid the mistakes we're making going forward. Because by God, there might be another COVID-19-2 pandemic in the next 5 years. So what kind of society do we want ourselves to be? How does it inform our stimulus package? How do we prepare our workforce for the possible dislocation that may occur by reinvesting in workforce training, like the Germans, to ensure that the shocks of an economic crisis can be withstand by the skills within our workforce?
And we have to make the case that, you know, as much as individual freedom is lovely, collective responsibility means something to you. That's what communities and nations are all about. It's not just about us, it's about others.
Yes.
And, you know, we are in this, I would say, really unprecedented time. Certainly, I'm kind of a student of economics, and I can't remember a circumstance. I certainly remember stagflation and other events where there seemed to be inconsistencies. But I don't remember a time where we had, on the one hand, an economic boom, and on the other hand, a depression. Yes. Not just a Great Recession, a depression. Half of our country is really in desperate straits. Small businesses closing, and you both know more employment comes in small and medium sized businesses than in large businesses in the United States. There are kids in the U.S. who are asked to study online who don't have access to broadband. They don't have access to computers. We don't have that as a utility as it should be. And on the other hand, the stock market is at historic highs. There's a complete divide. And I think, look, it's incumbent on all of us, and frankly, on everybody who's listening, who cares about this subject, to be active for and to call on leaders, and whether those are movement leaders or leaders in policy and business, to recognize that we simply have got to change to save our country. You know, our country won't be saved just because the FANG stocks are doing wonderfully. And I've got nothing against the FANG stocks. They're you know, they do some good business and they do some terrific things. They're innovative. But that alone is not going to propel the future of America.
And, you know, Paul, again, you're back on point. And as you were talking, I'm thinking about our own economic history and social history and what emerged from those forces. So the Great Depression created Social Security and other types of federal programs aimed at lifting the country out of the Depression. The Civil Rights Movement created the Fair Housing Act 67 and other mechanisms to help support minorities. Those are two separate shocks that we have to deal with. 2020 has three shocks, which has created for me a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Yes, you have this economic crisis that has brought the biggest negative effect on our economy in almost a century. You have COVID-19, a major health pandemic, first of its kind since the Spanish flu. And now you have Black Lives Matter, almost comparable in its scale to the civil rights movement of the 1960s. All three shocks are occurring simultaneously. And if we as a society and as an economy can't use this opportunity, this once-in-a-generation opportunity, to reevaluate our priorities, to establish new rules of engagement, to find new ways of bringing folks into the fold, and to fix our healthcare system, if this is not the time, it's never going to happen in our lifetime. And that's what I think this moment in our history represents. It's a trifecta of issues combining together at the same time in an election cycle that has given us a unique opportunity to think and act differently.
I would love to hear you guys talk about this forever because I have deep respect for both of you, and you have such heartfelt and thoughtful comments on all of this, but I'm going to have to wrap it up here, and I thank you both very, very much, Paul Irving and Gary Officer.
Thank you, Ramona. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Ramona. Great being with you. Gary, great seeing you. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
I'm Ramona Schindelheim. This is Work in Progress. Thank you for listening.